Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The topic of my talk is, what can philosophy tell us about angels? And particularly, I'm coming from the perspective of St. Thomas Aquinas. Notice, philosophy, Thomas Aquinas is by profession a theologian, but he was also a philosopher. If we want to have a demarcation between the two disciplines, philosophy is investigating reality in terms of what we can discern through natural reason, whereas theology is concerned with divine things based on premises drawn from revelation and accepted on faith. So I'm going to be lecturing on the side of philosophy here because that's my area of specialty. But of course, given the nature of the topic, there are going to be intersections between philosophical points and theological points that I'll acknowledge along the way, starting with the observation that the Catechism of the Catholic Church tells us that the existence of the spiritual, non-corporeal beings that sacred scripture usually calls angels is a truth of faith, end quote. Regarding this truth, the Catechism adds that, quote, the witness of Scripture is as clear as the unanimity of tradition, end quote. Writing more than 700 years earlier, St. Thomas Aquinas acknowledged this truth as a believing Catholic, but he also acknowledged it as a philosopher, since he told us, that the existence of angels and even something of their nature can be discovered by natural reason. And so, over the course of his career, he complements his theological considerations of the angels with a distinctly philosophical consideration of them. So again, it's this philosophical consideration that I will discuss today, addressing what Aquinas thinks we can discern about the angels independently of revelation. Now, when we begin to talk about angels in this way, there's this well-worn question that frequently pops into people's minds. I'm sure you may have heard the line, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? The origin of this question is, by all accounts, uncertain. But even though the question's provenance is unclear, its intent is all too clear, namely to satirize the thought and methodology of scholastic authors such as Aquinas. The question, therefore, is itself intended to be dismissive, but I intend tonight not to be dismissive of it in turn. Rather, my intention is to directly engage what is asked about the pin's head, and I will do so to make a point, namely, that from the consideration of objects such as pins and their heads, which are material, Aquinas thinks we are justified in drawing conclusions about an aspect of reality that some would say could not be pinned down, namely the immaterial. Now, to be clear, neither Aquinas nor any other scholastic thinker ever directly raised a question about angels in relation to the head of a pin. Still, we can find something of an answer to it in his writings, and in the course of searching for this answer, we will have a better understanding not only of his philosophy of the angels, but also of his metaphysical thought in general. To begin, we should first familiarize ourselves with Aquinas' terminology. The name angel is derived from the Greek word angelos, meaning messenger, and Aquinas tells us that the angels are called such because they make divine things known to human beings, as Gabriel did at the Annunciation. Unlike Mary, however, we know of their role as messengers only through revelation. For that reason, Aquinas tends to reserve the name angel for theological considerations about these beings. We should also be aware that Aquinas will use the name in a strict or limited sense, as well as with broader or more inclusive senses. In the strictest sense, angel is the name for the lowest choir of unfallen, created spiritual substances. In a broader sense, it's a name commonly used for all the unfallen created spiritual beings. And most broadly taken, it's a name for all created spiritual beings, including demons. My talk will concern angels in this broadest sense of the term. In more philosophical contexts, Aquinas employs a number of other names for these beings. Most commonly, he calls them separate substances, but also at times spiritual substances, divine things, necessary beings, and intelligences. The significance of each of these names will become apparent as we proceed to consider his thought in more detail. In his work entitled On the Separate Substances, Aquinas examines the merits of different philosophical accounts of these beings, looking at the writings of both pagan thinkers, such as Plato and Aristotle, and Islamic thinkers, such as Avicenna and Averroes. Aquinas sees their accounts of the beings that Christians identify as angels. Although he doesn't agree with everything these philosophers have to say about these beings, he nevertheless thinks that all of them convey some truth about angels to varying degrees. And looking at their thought, Aquinas adopts what he finds to be of merit, integrating it into his own philosophical account. Aquinas's notion of angelic nature is rooted in a basic Aristotelian understanding of reality. Following Aristotle, he holds that the material things of our experience consist of more than just material parts. Consider, for example, two dogs. My own dog, Frege, named after the German philosopher Gottlob Frege, and my friend's dog, Ziggy. Frege is a miniature long-haired dachshund, whereas Ziggy is a very large British bulldog. The two differ significantly in shape and size, but they share some very basic features in common. They both have the same kind of doggy nature. That nature, Aquinas contends, can't be explained merely by the sum of the parts, can't be explained merely by the matter. Rather, something other than those parts, something other than the matter, is needed to explain how the parts, how the matter is organized, structured. How is it, we might ask, that the matter in both dogs is organized in such a way that these two distinct individuals, nevertheless, are both the same kind of thing? Today, people would commonly answer this question by saying that the organizing principle here is DNA. If Aquinas were alive now, he would likely respond to this answer by asking, but how do we explain the organization of that DNA, since it too is made up of material parts? In short, his general point is that within a material being, something other than matter is needed to account for the organization of that matter. Following Aristotle, he calls this organizing principle form. Form is what gives the dogs Frege and Ziggy their nature as dogs. Each of them has his own form structuring his matter, but the key thing is that both have the same kind of form. So even though there are many material or physical differences between the two dogs, formally they are the same kind of thing. And as it is for dogs, so it is for all material beings, including human beings, plants, and even minerals. As may well be familiar to many of you, philosophers refer to this Aristotelian theory regarding the union of form and matter in physical things as hylomorphism, from the Greek word houle, meaning matter, and morphe, meaning form. Now Aquinas holds that just as dogs such as Frege and Ziggy have forms, so too do angels such as Gabriel and Michael. They must have forms, because if they exist at all, angels have a nature or essence. And that's exactly what form provides. To be more precise, however, Aquinas doesn't hold that angels merely have form. In fact, they are forms. The same can't be said of the dogs Frege and Ziggy. For them, their forms are only part of what they are as dogs, since matter is an essential part of them as well. Without matter, they couldn't do the kind of things that dogs do, such as chase cats, bark at mailmen, and pee on fire hydrants. By contrast, angels have no matter in them. They are immaterial beings. So Aquinas concludes that angels must be pure forms. Here again, his account is Aristotelian, for Aristotle had described just such formal beings in his work, The Metaphysics. It's because these beings exist separately from matter that Aristotle and Aquinas following him terms them separate substances. Moreover, Aquinas himself explains that separation from matter is what is indicated by the term spirituality. So it's for this reason that he also calls the angels spiritual substances. And for the same reason, namely their immateriality, these beings must be divine. So he calls them at times divine things. So far, all of what I have described may sound familiar and thoroughly reasonable. If angels are not physical things, it seems to make perfect sense that they must be pure forms. But in Aquinas' day, this position was in fact rather controversial. Most of his contemporaries, such as the seraphic doctor, St. Bonaventure, insisted that all created beings must be composed of form and matter, including angels. Scholars refer to this position as universal hylomorphism. That's not to say that the defenders of this view denied the incorporeal or spiritual nature of angels. Instead, what they held is that the type of matter in angels is a different sort of matter than corporeal matter. It's what they termed spiritual matter. Now, to speak of spiritual matter might sound odd, but the advocates of this theory had good reason to question Aquinas' position. To begin with, if the angels are pure forms, it seems as though there can't be more than one angel. Why this seems to be the case will be clearer if we consider how it is that corporeal things are diversified. Consider Frege and Ziggy again. As I mentioned, what makes both of them members of the same dog species is that they both have the same kind of form, a dog form. Since that form is what makes each of them such, namely a dog, it's not what makes either of them distinctly this, Frege or Ziggy, which is to say that their form doesn't account for their individuality. Instead, the hylomorphic theory holds that what makes a being such as Frege and Rover, and so too for all material things, individuals, is their matter. Matter individuates form. Because of his form, Frege is a dog. Because of his matter, Frege is this dog. So Aquinas sees matter as an individuating principle for corporeal things. But he also sees it, with that in mind, as a diversifying principle. The reason that there can be many dogs is precisely that the form of dog is present in many distinct quantities of matter. Just as there can be many gingerbread men with the same shape because that shape is present in different quantities of dough. Now, for the advocate of universal hylomorphism, such as Bonaventure, a parallel account is offered to explain the individuation and diversification of the angels. By this account, there are many different angels, the argument goes, because the form of angel is present in each angel's distinct spiritual matter. But Aquinas rejects universal hylomorphism and this notion of spiritual matter as philosophically problematic. We won't get into the details now, but we can discuss during the Q&A. It might seem then that his position would allow for the existence of only one angel, since an angelic form could not be multiplied. And in fact, this turns out to be Aquinas' position, in a way. He fully grants that as a pure form, an angelic form or nature can't be multiplied. But he doesn't see this as a problem. Aquinas simply responds that there are many different angels because each one exhausts and is unique in its species. In the truest sense of the expression, each angel is one of a kind. By contrast, with material things such as Frege and Zigi, there can be a multiplicity of individuals in the species because the same kind of form is received again and again in different quantities of matter. Since an angel is pure form, Aquinas concludes that the individual angel must be identical with its nature. Thus, whereas Frege is an individual that belongs to the species dog, Gabriel is an individual who belongs to the species, if you will, Gabriel, if we want to speak that way. Whereas Frege has dogness, and so does Ziggy, Gabriel is Gabriality. He is his Gabrielness. And since the individual who is Gabriel is identical with his Gabriality, no other angel can share in that nature. And the same can be said, mutatis mutandis, of Michael and his Michaelness, and so forth and so on. So in response to the proponents of universal hylomorphism, Aquinas grants that there can't be many different angels belonging to the same species, and yet he insists that there can be and are many angels, namely as individuals that are different species, many pure forms, each of which is one of a kind. Although Aquinas resolves the question of angelic multiplicity in this straightforward way, the advocates of universal hylomorphism think that his position poses a still greater problem. As all good Christian theologians and philosophers of the time agreed, only God is simple, since as the cause of all complexity and the cause of all multiplicity, he stands above all multiplicity, above all complexity. If Aquinas is right that the angels are pure forms, it seems that they would then also be perfectly simple. But that's not a possibility. And the position, from a theological standpoint, is heretical. So the objection goes that angels must be composed of something, and that something is form and spiritual matter, form with spiritual matter. Now, Thomas Aquinas, being a faithful Christian, a good theologian, and a subtle philosopher, fully acknowledged that God alone is perfectly simple. His response to these opponents was to embrace all the more the position that the angels are simple, but simple only in a certain respect. Not absolutely simple, but simple in this respect, as forms. It is precisely from that perspective that these beings are not perfect or entirely simple. To understand Aquinas' position, consider again the angels Gabriel and Michael. Both are beings, each with a distinct identity. One is not the other, and neither of them is anything else. Now, it's true, as I've noted, that each of these angels exhausts the fullness of his essence and species. Nevertheless, Aquinas explains, neither of them exhaust the fullness of existence. Gabriel is not simply a Gabriel. He's a being, something that exists. And to exist in a Gabriel way is not to exist in a Michael way, or in a you way, or in a me way. In short, Gabriel, Michael, or any other angel is merely one limited expression of the fullness of existence. That means that even though each angel is identical with its essence, Gabriel is Gabriality, no angel is identical with its existence. Gabriel is not existence itself. He's not his own act of existing. For this reason, Aquinas concludes that each angel's existence must be something other than, in addition to, its form. In short, each angel is this existing form. In the very way we phrase it, there is the intimation of composition, existing form. And so even though an angel is simple in the sense that it's not composed of form and matter, it's nevertheless complex, compound, in the sense that its form is composed with its very existence. In this way, Aquinas resolves the problem of angelic simplicity in terms of his famous distinction between essence and existence, or esse. Only in God is there no composition of these two, because only God is pure act, pure actuality, the pure act of existing by his very essence. And Aquinas concludes that that is why God is perfectly simple, not because he's pure form. Indeed, as a being of pure existence, God is, in a way, beyond all form. Drawing these distinctions between God and the angels, Aquinas shows that it is indeed possible for some created beings to exist as pure forms, entirely separate from matter. Still, to show that their existence is possible is not the same as to show that they do in fact exist. Aquinas, of course, as a Christian, believed that they do, but he also wanted to prove their existence philosophically. So over the course of his career, he presented several arguments to this end. Now, I'm not going to go into detail in these arguments in my talk. We can talk more about during the Q&A, but suffice it to say that what he considered to be his strongest arguments are based upon a common theme. So instead, what I'm going to do is present to you the basic pattern of his line of reasoning. Aquinas points out that when we consider the world around us, we notice a great ladder of being, a hierarchy of things in the universe, from lesser to greater nobility. For example, minerals like metals and stones have a very basic sort of existence. They're present in the world, but they don't act in the world so much as react to it. Plants stand above them on the ladder. Although plants contain minerals in them, they have a richer existence than the mere matter constituting them, because plants are alive. As living things, they do more than simply react to their environment. They interact with it through such activities as nourishment, growth, and reproduction. Animals have a still richer manner of existence, possessing the same basic traits as minerals and plants. Not only do they interact with the world, but they're capable of connecting with it to form an internal life through sensory knowledge. Next on this ladder of being stands the human person, who in a way possesses all of the perfections of these lower beings, but again, in a significant way, stands above them. Like other animals, human beings have sensory knowledge, but unlike them, we have in addition intellectual knowledge, knowledge that goes beyond mere sensations of the world, allowing us to penetrate to an understanding of the very essences of things. As Aquinas explains, this human ability is possible because, in addition to our material body, we also possess an immaterial soul. Why Aquinas sees a connection between intellectual knowledge and immateriality, I'll explain more in a moment. For now, suffice it to say that on the ladder of being, human beings are unique because we are a composition of the material and the immaterial. We're a sort of metaphysical amphibian. Still, this status doesn't rank human beings at the top of the ladder of being. Above us, of course, is God himself, who in his divine nature is purely immaterial and is the cause of all other beings. And as before, this higher being possesses what all the lower beings have, yet more profoundly. All those perfections had by his creatures, God has, but according to his mode of existence. Aquinas likes to say, every agent, every maker makes things like itself, or everything that's made is like its maker, but in a higher way. So if you make a chair, well, you're not making the chair like you as a human being, but like the idea in your mind. Well, God has in an immaterial, simple, and unified way all the perfections of the things that he makes. Now, I should note that Aquinas thinks God's existence can also be proven philosophically, but we don't have time to consider those arguments here. Looking at this ladder of being, Aquinas next points out that, as I've presented it so far, it's incomplete. I listed three basic types of beings. First, created beings that are material. Second, created beings, namely humans, that are a composition of the material and the immaterial. And third, an uncreated being that is purely immaterial. Aquinas contends that one class of being is clearly missing from the list. It's as if in listing these beings, I have counted from 1 to 10 and left out the number 9. In the very skipping of the number, it's obvious that it should be there. Regarding the ladder of being, what he thinks is left out from the list as I've presented it so far are created immaterial beings. Even though I may have neglected them at first count, Aquinas contends that God did not. In short, what he argues is that we can conclude to the existence of angels because such immaterial beings are needed for the perfection of the universe. Like a Christmas tree without an angel to top it off, the created universe would be incomplete without the angels to top it off. In short, Aquinas sees their existence in this world as in some way necessary. But he's careful to note that their existence is not absolutely necessary. In other words, God didn't have to create them, just as he didn't have to create us. Nothing can force God's hand. Instead, Aquinas explains that the existence of angels is conditionally necessary. To illustrate what he means by conditional necessity, Aquinas gives the example of the construction of a house. Given the condition that a builder freely chooses to build a house, he needs to provide it with its essential parts, such as walls and a roof. And similarly, given the condition that God has freely chosen to create this universe, it was necessary for him to provide it with its own essential parts. And Aquinas argues that we can infer from the order of the universe, which we experience, and from God's goodness, which he thinks we can prove, that just as minerals, plants, animals, and humans are essential parts of the universe, so too are created immaterial beings, namely the angels. The philosophical question that next arises is whether this line of reasoning provides what philosophers will refer to as a demonstrative argument, one that proves its conclusion definitively with certitude, or whether maybe it's a merely probable argument whose conclusion is reasonable, maybe highly likely, but not definitive. Having researched this topic and looking at Aquinas' arguments and his attitude towards them and his language, I think it's clear that Aquinas himself views the line of reasoning to be demonstrative. He tells us that it is based upon a conditional necessity and one that follows not from a lack of freedom on God's part, not as though his power necessitated it, his productive power, the way, well, if the sun is going to radiate, heat and light, well then, it cannot but do that given that it's the sun. It's not even from his goodness, as though his goodness necessitated it. The Neoplatonic philosophers have an axiom that the good is diffusive of itself, And they say, you know, God is goodness itself and he cannot help but give. Aquinas adopts that axiom but recasts it in an Aristotelian way to say, yeah, but good is an end or goal, not a producer, an efficient cause. So it's in accord with the ends of God that he produces things in accord with his goodness. So he's not necessitated in any of these ways. So where does this conditional necessity come from? Aquinas argues it's from the order of his wisdom. Now, my personal thought is that his line of reasoning is merely a probable argument, since we don't have the vantage point of knowing God's wisdom directly. At the very least, I think that Aquinas has shown philosophically not only that it's reasonable to conclude that such immaterial beings exist, but that also God has good reason to have made them. Having considered his views regarding the immateriality of the angels, we're now in a better position to begin to answer that question. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Really, how many angels can fit on the head of a pin? Because it should be clear by now that since angels don't have bodies, it's impossible for them to waltz, tango, or perform any other sort of dance moves anywhere, much less on a pin. So as I say, let's consider instead the slightly more serious phrasing, how many angels can fit on the head of a pin? As before, Aquinas doesn't address this question, this phrasing of the question directly, any more than he does the prior phrasing. But he does consider the question of whether an angel can be in a place. And in doing so, he provides some insight into how to answer our question. Aquinas notes, first of all, that we need to understand what it means to be in a place. Take yourself as an example. You are here in this room on your chair. The reason that you can be in a place such as that is due to the fact that you've got a body and that your body has quantitative dimensions with a surface. This enables you to be contained, in Aquinas' language, circumscriptively by the surrounding area, by the surfaces of other bodies. Those surfaces themselves are quantitative dimensions. And that area containing you is an example of a place. So given this notion of place and what it means to be in a place, it should be clear that angels can't be in a place at all. Because they're immaterial, they don't possess any dimensions that can be contained by any surrounding area. Since the head of a pin would constitute a place, I think we can conclude from Aquinas' reasoning that the number of angels that could fit there would have to be zero. No angels can fit on the head of a pin because angels can't fit on or in anything at all. So it seems we've answered our question. But in fact, there's more to the story. When Aquinas himself would answer a question, he frequently responded in the trademark scholastic way, seek et non, which is to say, well, in a certain way, yes, but in a certain way, no. And he offers just such a response to the question of whether an angel can be in a place. No, he tells us, it can't be in a place in the sense of being contained by that place, since an angel doesn't have a body. But he also says that, yes, it can be in a place in another sense. To figure out what that other sense is, and therefore to calculate how many angels could actually fit on the head of a pin, we need to examine further Aquinas' philosophical account of angelic nature. Considering the immateriality of angels in their nature, Aquinas deduces several other important attributes that they must possess. Since they are immaterial, they differ significantly from the physical things all around us. Those things will all eventually corrupt and go out of existence. Animals and plants will die. Wood will decompose. Even mountain ranges rise and fall. Aquinas explains that the reason these material things have the potential for corrupting in this way is precisely that they are material. If we consider the hylomorphic doctrine, the Aristotelian doctrine of hylomorphism again, matter is always formed in some way, but that matter always has the potency, the potential, the capacity to take on a new and different form. It's because all material things have that potential for corruption built into them in their nature, Aquinas refers to them as contingent beings. Their existence is contingent or dependent upon the continued presence of their form in their matter. Once the matter breaks down sufficiently, the form will no longer remain, and neither will that being. Since angels have no matter, we can conclude that they have no potency for corruption. In short, they can't die or go out of existence, at least by natural means. Given the kind of things that they are, by their natures, they must continue to exist. And that's why, following Aristotle, but also the Arabic philosopher Avicenna, Aquinas at times refers to the angels as necessary beings. Still, he's careful to note the sense in which their existence is necessary. God can also be called a necessary being because he too can't go out of existence. He exists by his very essence, as we discussed. But God derives his necessity entirely from himself, therefore. By contrast, the angels, the necessity of the angels, is not from themselves but from God, since he created angels as the kind of thing that they are and given them existence. And since the angel's necessity was given to it by God, God can also take that necessity away, which is to say that God can annihilate the angels. But have no fear, Thomas tells us that because of his goodness, God will never do that. Another attribute that Aquinas deduces from the angel's immateriality is its intelligence. To understand why angels must be intelligent, we need to briefly consider Aquinas' account of knowledge. Even the most basic animal has a kind of knowledge. Frege, for example, can recognize his master's, my voice, and respond to my commands. But all of Frege's knowledge is based simply upon sensory cognition. It's a knowledge of concrete, particular things, by Aquinas' Aristotelian account. This is obvious in a case where Frege is smelling a particular smell on a particular tree, but even when he is responding to my voice by using his memory and imagination, he's recalling a concrete particular image. He doesn't understand the full significance of my words because language conveys more than what is concrete and particular. Language is not just sounds, it's significative. Human beings have the same sort of sensory knowledge that Frege has, but we also have a higher type of knowledge, namely intellectual knowledge. We're capable of knowing, for example, not just this dog, Frege, but what all dogs share in common. In other words, we're able to understand in a universal way the nature of what it is to be a dog. We're able to grasp the form of a thing, and that form is not something that can be sensed. Unlike sensory knowledge, therefore, universal knowledge, Aquinas contends, must be abstract, which is to say that it must be immaterial. Now, it's true that the concept of dog signifies something material and refers back to physical dogs that you are able to see and touch. But the concept itself is not a physical thing. You can't see dogness. You can't touch dogness. And what Aquinas maintains is that such immaterial concepts can be present in the mind only if the mind is immaterial as well. Here's another medieval axiom he liked to trot out. Whatever is received according to the mode of the receiver. I like to give my students the example of pouring water into a pitcher. I don't know if people are familiar with the Kool-Aid guy, that pitcher. If you pour water into the Kool-Aid guy, well, it's received in a Kool-Aid guy shaped kind of way. If you pour it into the Mrs. Butterworth syrup bottle, I don't know if those still exist, but it's going to take on a, it's be received in a Mrs. Butterworth kind of way. If concepts are indeed abstract and universal and immaterial, as Aquinas contends. Whatever is receiving them must itself be immaterial. Then he flips it. Since the angels are immaterial beings, Aquinas concludes that they too must engage in this immaterial activity of intellectual knowing. Unlike us, though, they don't have sensory knowledge because they don't have bodies. So their knowledge is entirely intellectual, and it's for this reason that Aquinas sometimes calls the angels intelligences or intellects, following Pseudo-Dionysius and Avicenna. As purely intellectual beings, they don't acquire knowledge the way we do. Following Aristotle, Aquinas holds that when we're born, our minds are like a blank slate. We need to acquire our knowledge of the world by experiencing it. And we experience it by sensing it. We're embodied knowers. The angels don't learn in this way. Without sense organs, they can't learn in this way. Unlike us, they aren't born with a blank slate for a mind. Aquinas contends, in fact, they aren't born at all. Rather, they're immediately created by God with ideas impressed into their very natures. So Aquinas rejects the notion of the rationalist notion of innate ideas for human cognition. He thinks that's got to be the model of cognition for these spiritual beings. And in considering these innate ideas, they understand not only spiritual things like other angels, but even physical things, because the likeness of things like Frege, Ziggy, you, and me are impressed upon their intellects. Aquinas contends furthermore that their knowledge is much more powerful than ours is. Since we human knowers do need to acquire knowledge from sense experience, we need to reason things through step by step. And that's why Aquinas follows that classical Aristotelian definition of human, man, rational animal. We are animals that reason discursively, step by step, syllogistically. But angels are not animals, and neither do they reason. As purely intellectual beings, he contends, they can grasp a whole argument at a single glance. Furthermore, just as the angels have higher cognitive powers than we do, some have higher powers than do others. As you'll recall, I noted earlier that no two angels are of the same species. But the difference between any two angels, by Aquinas' argumentation, is not merely a difference in kind. Yes, it's that. But because they are entirely immaterial, the only way for one angel to be formally different from another is for it to be of greater or lesser nobility than the other. That's why Aquinas identifies a hierarchy among the angels. And this hierarchy is not merely in terms of the nine choirs presented in Scripture and discussed by theologians. Aquinas explains that when asked, are these the genera, the genus into which these different angels belong, based on their natures, but he says, no, those orders are based upon the offices assigned them by God. The lowest order are the messengers, the highest, the seraphim, praise God. But in their natures, they're not grouped into nine choirs. They all differ, each from one to the next, hierarchically. So Aquinas holds that there must be as many metaphysical rankings of angels as there are individuals. In sum, if we consider that ladder of being again, each angel occupies its own rung. From the angel's immateriality, Aquinas deduces truths not only about their knowledge, but also about their desires. Since they don't have bodies, neither do the angels have the sort of bodily desires that we have. That means that they don't have emotions, they can't have lust or fear, be angry or sad. But they do have another sort of desire that we humans have, namely an intellectual desire. This is nothing other than what we commonly call the will. Since angels are pure intellects, they too must have wills. And since the sort of judgment an intellectual being can make is freely made, their wills must also be free. So we now hopefully have a better picture of Aquinas' account of angelic nature, and this will help us to see how these immaterial beings can interact with the material world, in turn revealing how angels could, in any sense of the word, be on a material thing like the head of a pin, such that we could count them. When Aquinas considered how the angels are related to the rest of the universe, one possibility that he addressed is that they somehow act as creative causes, making things ex nihilo. This was the view of, for example, the Islamic philosopher Avicenna. Aquinas, however, rejects this sort of role for the angels, not only because it is theologically erroneous, but also because he thinks that it is philosophically unsound. To create is to be the cause of the very existence of beings. It's to produce something out of absolute nothingness. When finite beings, created beings, make things, they always make them out of pre-existing material. Carpenters make chairs out of wood. Chickens make chickens out of eggs. No finite being can make something out of absolutely nothing, because to do so requires, by Aquinas' estimation, an infinite power. Now, as I've already noted, no angel exhausts the fullness of existence, but rather each and every angel exists in a limited way. And so each is a finite being with finite, limited power. Only God, as the fullness of existingness itself, is infinite. So Aquinas concludes only God has the kind of causal power required to create. Still, Aquinas holds that in other ways, angels can and do act as influences in the world. The question arises, however, how an immaterial being could interact with the material. How a spirit can act on a body without coming into physical contact. To answer this question, he asks us first to consider the human soul, which bears some similarities to angels, but also differences. The noteworthy difference is that even though the human soul can exist apart from the body, namely after death, that state of separation is not its natural condition. Following the Aristotelian doctrine of hylomorphism, Aquinas is clear that the complete human person is a union of soul and body, in which the soul is the form of the body. And he famously states at one point, I, rarely does he use the first person singular, but it's noteworthy when he does, and he says, I am not my soul. And what he means is, that's not the whole of me. I'm not a soul trapped in a body. I'm a human being, which is a composite of soul and body. This is all to say that humans are not immaterial beings. Nevertheless, even though the whole of us is not immaterial, that part of us that is the soul is immaterial. As Aquinas explains, the human soul can be called immaterial because it is there that the intellect is located. And it is by means of this intellective soul that we're able to command our very bodies. For example, I can think to myself, you know, it would be good to make a point to move my arm right now. I can then will to do so, and voila, my arm raises. By this simple immaterial act of the will, he contends, my immaterial soul is able to have an effect on my material body. So what does all this have to do with angels? Well, like the human soul, angels are also immaterial and intellectual. Moreover, they are intellectually more powerful than we are, and as Aquinas notes, what the lower can do, the higher can do in a more powerful way. So he concludes that if our souls are capable of immediately moving bodies, all the more so are angels capable of doing so, albeit in a more powerful way. And I emphasize in a more powerful way, because even though a human soul is able to immediately move a body by a simple act of will, it's limited in its ability to do this. My soul can't immediately move just any old body. It can't move that chair over there. It can't move you. Rather, it can immediately move only one body, my own body, to which it is uniquely joined. Unlike a human soul, however, an angel isn't joined to any body. It's a pure form, a pure spirit. With its greater power, then, an angel has the ability to move each and every body that there is. Still, Aquinas adds, because an angel is a finite or limited being, it can't move all bodies at once, but only one at a time. Here we begin to see an answer to the question of how an angel can be in a place even though it is not a physical being. Although it is not in a place as though contained by its surrounding area, the bodies that it can act upon are themselves so contained. With that in mind, Aquinas explains that an angel can be said to be in a place inasmuch as it applies its power to a physical thing that is itself located in some place. So let's consider again that famous pin. If it were lying on the table and an angel chose to apply its power to the pin's head, moving it across the table by a mere act of its will, we could say that the angel is in that particular place. As Aquinas puts it, the angel would be there virtually, from the Latin word virtus, in this case meaning power, not our contemporary virtual reality. But he's careful to add that the place where the angel would be located would not contain the angel as it contains the pin. To the contrary, we would do better to say that what is contained is in fact the place itself. It's contained, if you will, by the angel, the way our bodies can be said to be contained by our souls. When considered in this respect, it is possible for an angel to be on the head of a pin, namely, in an analogical way. But is it possible for more than one angel to fit there? Again, Aquinas doesn't directly answer this question for us. He does, however, explain that more than one angel can't be in the same place at the same time. In other words, more than one can't apply its power to that same place simultaneously. And the reason is that two complete causes of the same order can't act on the same area at the same time. They could do so only if their modes of causality were in different orders. For example, both God and an angel could act on the same place at the same time because each would act as a cause in a different respect. If we consider again the head of our pin, God would be present there as causing the pin's very existence, whereas the angel would be present as causing its motion through space. But two angels could not be present there simultaneously, because then both would be complete causes in the same respect, namely of motion. So if we take the pin's head as a single place, and if we speak in terms of an angel's virtual presence on it, we get a new answer to our question regarding how many angels can fit on the head of the pin. Only one. But we need to be careful not to have limited vision here. The head of a pin may be quite small, but it still has parts to it. For example, a left half and a right half. In this respect, it can be treated as consisting of more than one place, and different angels could thus apply their respective powers to each place. In this way, at least two angels could be on the head of a pin. The pin's head could be divided further in terms of top and bottom, allowing for four places where four angels could be present. So how many divisions could there be? Well, considering the nature of a surface area, from an Aristotelian perspective, Aquinas notes that any surface contains an infinite number of points. Does that mean that he would say an infinite number of angels could be on the pin's head by means of their power? Well, in fact, no. In part, because that infinitude of points on the pin's head are not all actually present at once, as though the pin's head were constructed or composed of lots of points. They're only potentially there in as much as the head can be divided again and again and again. But also, he seems to reject the notion of an infinitude of angels there, in part because, at least by the time of later texts, he thinks there cannot be an actually infinite number of creatures, although he does entertain that possibility in some earlier texts and leaves it undecided. But by the later Summa Theologiae, he says, no, this is not possible. Both of these are physical and metaphysical points, too complex to examine in detail. Maybe we can get into it again during the Q&A. Suffice it to say, Aquinas would hold that a pinhead could be divided into an extremely large number of actual places where an angel could be present by its power. So many so that whereas the number of angels would be fewer than an infinite set, the possible number is clearly greater than one, and in fact would be extraordinarily large. In fact, it seems that given Aquinas' account of the divisibility of a physical surface, the number of locations could allow for as many angels as God has in fact created, a number that Aquinas tells us must be far beyond all material multitude. So as it turns out, in sum, we have seen that there are three different ways to answer the question, how many angels can fit on the head of a pin? If we consider the physical presence that they could have there, we found that the answer is zero, because they can't have a physical presence in place. If we consider the virtual presence that they could have there, and if we treat the head of a pin as a single place, we found that the answer is one. But if we consider the number of places that are potentially located on the head of the pin, we found that the number of angels that could fit there would be exceedingly great. And in the course of attempting to answer this question, we learned something both about the nature of angels and their relationship to the world. To conclude, what I've provided here is merely a brief sketch of Aquinas' philosophical account of the angels. In his writings, of course, he goes into much greater detail about their inner life and their role in the universe. Unfortunately, to the contemporary mind, talking about these immaterial beings at all sounds like so much nonsense. The very term immaterial has become synonymous with the words irrelevant and insignificant. But a sincere reading of Aquinas' works reveals that this attitude is all too dismissive. For believing Christians, considering the angels is both relevant and significant to one's faith. But in addition, considering them is also relevant and significant for us as human beings. For as Aquinas frequently reminds us with the words of Aristotle, all human beings by nature desire to know. Given the great ladder of being that we encounter in this world, therefore, it's perfectly natural that we should wish to raise our intellects above a consideration of material beings to contemplate ones that are immaterial, to contemplate those beings that are called angels. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.